Another fine show brought to you by the Law of Attraction Radio Network. The Law of Attraction Talk Radio is the radio show that is changing the world through science and spirituality as we realize that our well-being and our happiness is through our own thoughts. The Law of Attraction Talk Radio, the Jules. Well, welcome to Law of Attraction Talk Radio. I'm Jules from beautiful, clean, refreshing, and even open-minded Southern California. Well, tonight's guest is Sarini Pillay, MD, psychiatrist, and assistant clinical professor at Harvard Medical School. And he just finished his course at the University of Attraction. The course is still playing in its entirety, so I urge you to go and listen to it because it's an eye-opener and truly explains how the brain works as it pertains to the Law of Attraction. Really valuable information. And tonight, Dr. Pillay and I will explore such topics as Charlie Sheen, religion, and the most effective way to use visualization. It's a great show with my favorite MD, so stay tuned. We'll be right back. You are listening to your daily dose of well-being and inspiration on Law of Attraction Radio Network at loaradionetwork.com. Hear this incredible show on your smartphone through Stitcher.com, which goes through your car stereos with Ford Sync or any auto dashboard that has the internet. Listen to our 24/7 broadcast with the mobile app as well, or just listen through your MP3 player or computer. Remember, loaradionetwork.com, heard in over 120 countries, is the station for your well-being.
Hello, I'm Melody Green from the Creative Soul Cafe. I can't wait to share with you my new workshop, The Soul's Journey. It's interactive, hands-on, and runs for 12 weeks at the University of Attraction. With discussion groups and weekly modules to download, we'll explore the hidden codes in your DNA and use my new tools, the Emotional Bagua, to help create your success. If you're ready to follow your passionate life purpose, claim your place at The Soul's Journey. Subscribe now.
Here's the most incredible singles cruise ever. That's right. Law of Attraction Radio Network with SpiritualSingles.com and MatchMatrix.com is putting on the most incredible cruise full of fun and romance. No matter your age, size, ethnicity, or whether you're single or in a long-term relationship, join us to spark up your love life. Our four-night cruise starts on Thursday, October 27th. We set sail from Miami to Key West to Cozumel. Join our relationship experts, tantra experts, love angel communicator, energy healer, and our very own laughing yoga, who will be assisting you in making this the best adventure of your life into love. Rates start off at $5.99, which includes all of the workshops. There are balcony cabins still available, but you must sign up immediately. Rates will go up dramatically after March 28th. Don't wait. Sign up with your $150 refundable deposit and book your cabin now. Oh, and by the way, don't forget to bring your costume for a wonderful evening of fun. Go to loaradionetwork.com and don't forget to tell us who referred you. We'll see you on board. Oh, I am so excited about this cruise. I've already booked my balcony cabin and I'm planning a really hilarious costume. And I really want you to join me. So I have a very special offer for all the members of the University of Attraction. Listen up because it's amazing. All U of A members will receive $150 off the cruise rate. That's right, I said $150. So go sign up for the University of Attraction and come on the cruise with a major savings of $150. If you really want to go,
but you need to manifest the funds to go, then join me every Wednesday evening at the University of Attraction at 6 p.m. Pacific to put your intention of the cruise and finding your true love in the Red Jewel box. We have energy healer Janice Duncan energizing your intention with me, and it's very, very powerful. Every week we've been celebrating the manifestations that have come to be from this, and it's nothing short of incredible. In less than a month, people are receiving their full intentions. Besides that, I personally want to get to know each one of you through this live video course, and I really love it. So join me at the University of Attraction and receive $150 off the price of the cruise. Join me, and don't wait, because the cabins are going so fast. Speaking of the U of A, we're going to have some brand new courses coming up that have to do with the scientific findings of UFO and aliens. You know, other countries are releasing all of this information, and you're going to be getting the inside scientific scoop on this from a best-selling scientific author. That's just some of the classes coming up. Now, moving on, if you haven't tuned in to Stefan with the Shu'em Soul Experience, you need to. And be sure you listen with your headset, because he truly has an incredible healing meditation that's just nothing short of fabulous. And I'm going to mention that Design Your Dream Life with my favorite Frenchman living in Ireland, Bertrand Dory, is really becoming a huge hit. Women are falling in love with this guy, so tune in and find out why. And coming up on Law of Attraction Radio Network in just a few short weeks, we're going to be having our own Laughing Yoga Show with Laughing Ann. I am so excited about this. I was talking to her on the phone the other day, and I couldn't stop laughing, even talking with her, so I know the show is going to be a huge hit. As a matter of fact, we're going to put it on prime time in the morning so that everybody can listen to it as they're driving to work. What a great commute and a great way to lift your vibration up for the whole day ahead. So now, I want to bring back my favorite MD, Dr. Sereni Pillay. Now, even though Dr. Pillay doesn't need an introduction, let me just mention a few things, especially for the new listeners. Dr. Pillay is a psychiatrist and clinical assistant professor at Harvard Medical School, having done brain imaging studies that reveal the law of attraction is real and authentic. He is also the best-selling author of Life Unlocked: 7 Revolutionary Lessons for Overcoming Fear, and The Science Behind the Law of Attraction, and The Neuroscience of Great Leaders, Your Brain and Business. That's his latest book, and I'm really anxious to read it. So welcome back, Dr. Sereni Pillay.
Thank you very much for having me. It's really good to be back.
And I just got to mention what a brilliant course you put on at the University of Attraction. 6 sessions.
Thank you very much. You know, it was as much of a thrill for me, on so many levels. I think, firstly, preparing the materials was, helpful to me because I felt like I was reviewing things in order to be able to communicate some of the things I already know and some of the things that we know from brain science. So for me, it was a very rewarding experience personally, and it was also really rewarding to be able to share this information with the people who were looking this up.
I love the fact that you did this course through a live video presentation. This was incredible. I felt as if I was in the same room with you as you were relaying all your information.
No, I really enjoy that medium. You know, I think being able to be there live and at the same time show the slides and talk was really trying to take advantage of as many things as we could, because it does make a difference, I think, once you get a sense of the person rather than simply seeing something in
writing. Right. You know, today I want to dive into the visualization that you talked about in your course, because I thought it was brilliant. But along those lines, I also want to just kind of talk about Charlie Sheen, because I find it fascinating that Charlie Sheen plays the same character that he is displaying in real life. Could it be that the repetition of playing this same character, i.e. visualizing and becoming that person, is actually affecting his brain, that he can't pick out what's real and not?
Well, we can't say for sure, but I think if you're asking, is it possible, I would say absolutely. And I think, you know, unless one is actually close to Charlie Sheen, it's hard to tell how much of each factor contributes to what's going on for him right now. But my feeling is that if with a lot of actors, especially when they're good at what they do and they get absorbed in their roles, they actually begin to completely take on this role, both in terms of visualization and in terms of action. And so their brains have held on to a certain kind of character through this visualization. And so it's not inconceivable. In fact, it's fairly likely that playing these roles can actually intrude upon your everyday life. I think it actually takes a lot of skill and it takes a lot of practice to be able to inhibit those roles. And I think there have been a number of anecdotal reports that actors who are absorbed in their role sometimes lose themselves in their roles and end up representing those roles in real life. You know, I think for a seasoned actor or perhaps one who has been well informed, I think a lot of actors know that it's important to take a break and it's important to go out of role as well. And I think it's as important to be out of role as it is to be in role. And what that means in terms of brain science is that if you are sustaining some kind of visualization in your brain for a period of time, it's important to let that go.
Fascinating. And that brings to mind Marilyn Monroe, who played some really tough roles that she later manifested into her life, as well as another lady actor whose name was Helen, I believe, who portrayed a woman who was dying of a terminal brain tumor. And then, 5 years later, she did die of a brain tumor.
Absolutely. You know, I think we have to be careful about what we're taking in, and we have to really be clear about what we're doing. I think one of the things for actors is really to be able to have someone who's coaching them through the process so that they can be in the role itself, but at the same time, not necessarily take that on. Now, I think because we don't have studies done on this and because we don't have evidence to show that these are not just chance occurrences, actors may feel that they're protected. But what I would say is, let's at least say we don't know, and let's say that there is a biological plausibility that this could happen. Because when people take in information and they represent this in their brain, if they're particularly good, they actually will begin to completely absorb the character. And what that means is that the brain cells that fire when they fire to represent that character start representing that character in you, and that firing continues even when you're outside of that role.
Wow. So would you say that the length of time that an actor plays a role makes a difference?
I think it's both the amount of time and also the depth of experience. And I also think it's the type of acting method that you use. You know, because with method acting, for example, one of the techniques is to try to imagine being that character and then playing the role of that character. And different actors play these roles in different ways. Some people take on the personality. Some people mimic the personality. I think everybody tries to be as authentic as possible. And especially when they're trying to watch a role, you know, for example, if they have a role where they're playing someone who's sick, a lot of times actors will watch people who are sick so that they can see what their expressions look like. And when that happens, it's actually activating the mirror neurons in their own brain. And so those mirror neurons start firing. And the question is, when they start firing, do they ever stop?
So putting this in terms of everyday living from everyone that are not actors, would you say that it's important to be living and portraying our authentic life instead of living life projecting to be something other than what we are?
Absolutely. you know, I think it's important for us to be very aware both of what we're taking in and what we're giving off. You know, the whole law of attraction hypothesis is that we, in life, you get what you put out. And I think in this course, what we did is we described how in different situations, you do in fact get what you put out. That, for example, if you are putting out a sense of impossibility, you often get impossibility back. If you are putting out a sense of fear, you often get that fear back. And in the course, we describe the biology of this and talk about how when you express fear, this fear actually registers in the brain of an observer. And so emotions at that level are contagious, and they can actually move across space. So I think the fact that we're all connected in these ways, the fact that we actually can register things from each other, means that apart from being aware of ourselves, it's really important to be aware of other people. And, you know, increasingly, research is showing that this is particularly important because social intelligence, which is an intelligence that's associated with being able to be aware of social interactions and the ramifications of those interactions, can actually affect a large number of things. You know, it can affect the way you feel, because if you take in someone else's emotions without actually checking yourself, you may be just representing what they're feeling. It can increase the level of trust and understanding. So social intelligence and the ability to think just beyond yourself is extremely important. I think the initial point you made about authenticity is also important, because part of what we're doing when we're being authentic is representing ourselves. And I think that for most human beings, because we all have some kind of foible, or we have something about ourselves that we don't want to represent to the public, we often end up inhibiting that, which I think is probably appropriate, because I don't think everyone's going to be understanding about all our positive and negative things. But I think to the extent that we can keep those things to ourselves, but at the same time continue to be true or represent ourselves as truly as possible, or even hold ourselves to some sense of that as a goal, I think we'll be much further on than if we just don't think about that at all.
In the law of attraction, there is a saying that you treat somebody how you would want to be treated, because in effect it's mirroring.
That's one of the things. You know, I think if you treat somebody well, if you look at it really literally, if you treat someone well, it makes you feel good. The goodness that you feel reflects in their brain. When they start to feel good, and they're feeling then not just the goodness of receiving what you're giving, but the goodness of representing in their brain the goodness that you're feeling, they want to give that back to you. And so when you give goodness out, you often get goodness back.
Yep.
Now, having said that, there will be people who are listening to this who say, but, you know, I've tried my whole life to try to be good, and every time I'm good, people will always slap me in the face. And what I would say to that is, examine your expectations. Because even when you're good, if somehow your early life experience was disappointing, your brain's expectation may be to be slapped in the face, and maybe that's a stronger activation, even though it's unconscious. You may be causing someone to respond negatively to you because you expect that response.
Each week with your course, you had people download a goal assistant, and that actually helped you clarify and get straight in your mind where you were focusing on and where you were stuck. I thought that was brilliant.
I think the whole purpose of the goal assistant was multifold. One of the purposes was to be able to give people a check-in point so they could check in to see whether they had covered the major parts of what needed to be done for the exercises. And the other was also to be able to give them a way to examine themselves and say, you know what, I actually did do the imagination exercise, but I didn't involve emotion. And so maybe that's where I was stuck. Or they would say, I did the imagination and I did involve emotion, except that I was talking to myself in do not talk. So perhaps I need to talk to myself differently. So once they use the goal assistant, they'll actually be able to see where they may be slipping up. And then they can focus on that region and practice in that particular region.
And that's very important. Now let's talk about visualization, because I thought the way that you put this down was brilliant, and I really never heard about it before. You say that it's good to visualize in either the third person or the first person, and you explained why. Let's go into that.
Sure. Well, the basic message was that when you visualize, it's important to visualize both in the first person and in the third person. And part of the reason we know this is that when you visualize in the third person, you can often feel more motivated, and you can feel like you can reach your goals more clearly. You know, there were some studies that were done that showed that people who watched the elections on TV beforehand, when they imagined going to vote in the third person, which means they saw themselves in front of themselves without actually being in the situation, they were more likely to go vote than if they imagined in the first person. So in those situations, when people imagine in the third person, it's extremely important because they're able to take that imagination and convert it into action. When you imagine in the first person, what you're actually doing is activating the brain more. So in some ways, imagination in the first person is preferable. The problem with that is that when you activate so strongly, not everybody can deal with being in the situation in real time. So just to distinguish between first person and third person to remind people, first person is a little bit like watching yourself be in a 100-meter race so that you can't see your eyes and you can't see your back. All you can do is see the track in front of you. Third person is where you see yourself running the race, but you can see your eyes and you can see your back. You literally just look at all of yourself. So what I was saying was that I think first and third person are important. First, with first person imagery, aside from getting a stronger activation, you often get faster reaction time. So you're able to execute on the action faster. This, however, is diminished if you become very anxious. So the procedure is start in the third person, and once you get used to imagining in the third person, switch over to the first person. And the reason being that third person imagery is very effective in getting people to their goals, and first person imagery is probably stronger, but will not work if you have not mastered the anxiety of imagining. The truth that most people don't recognize about imagining is that imagining is not just creating an image in your head. Imagining is also having feeling associated with that. So when you put yourself in that 100-meter race, when you put yourself in the imagining of losing that weight, when you put yourself on that date, you know, your heart will be beating pretty fast. And so if your heart is beating so fast that you can't even create the image in your brain, then there's no point to it. You know, we also talked about the fact that stress actually deactivates the part of the brain that's responsible for creating an image. So you don't want to be so stressed that you can't create the image in your brain. And so what you start to do is, instead of saying, okay, I'm imagining myself at the table, my knife and fork in front of me, the food, the person I love across from me, instead of doing that, what you do is remove yourself from the picture and watch yourself as though you're watching a movie of yourself. And once you get that down, you then put yourself in the situation so you can increase the strength of your activation to get to your goals.
Wow, that is such powerful information. You know, it reminds me of the computer games like Second Life or Cyrus World, where you have avatars and you can actually go in there and see yourself in either the first person or the third person and follow yourself around.
That's right. You know, when you are controlling a figure that's in front of you, you see this in a lot of computer games, you see this, you know, in the old arcade games, those kinds of things where you have a joystick, and as you move the joystick, you're controlling the figure, or you have a button that moves something. You're controlling in the third person if you are looking at someone else. However, there are some games where, for instance, if you're in a car, you actually feel as though you are in the
right
car. You don't actually see yourself. And that kind of game is where you're playing in the first place.
So this seems to be the perfect place to ask you about all of those computer games that children are playing with that have to do with violence and killing and Mortal Kombat. Do those games, in fact, create killers?
So that's a difficult question to answer. What I can say is that the research shows that children who watch those kinds of violent shows are more likely to take in that violence and pick it up and represent it. So I think that that's true. The reason I say it's difficult to comment on is that violence is a real part of our society. And so, you know, when you think of the ideal world where you don't want to expose your child to any violence, it sounds great unless your child then goes out into the world and is completely shocked by the thought of violence. So the idea is, once you watch the violence, I think you have to moderate the amount of violence you're being exposed to. And then secondly, so think about, well, if I want my child to learn something about violence, what do I want them to learn? That when there is violence around, it causes these kinds of things, that violence is not a solution to problems, that, you know, so I think that there are positive things about being able to see violence so that you can talk about it intelligently. And what I would recommend is, rather than create a situation where your child has no idea of violence and is totally shocked by the fact that violence exists in the world, I think moderating the exposure to violence is important, but having intelligent discussions around that is equally important. And I think if you can create the right balance for that, you're in a good position.
Wow. Now, when I was in your course, something really hit me between the eyes, and that was about the possibility of burnout. I was amazed because I really could see me in there. So let's talk about this.
Sure. Well, I talk about burnout in terms of possibility thinking. And what I was saying was that, you know, sometimes we think that things in life are impossible. And part of the reason we think it's impossible is because of a number of different reasons. And one of the reasons is that we're so burnt out that we can't even conceive of something possible. Now, when we think about burnout, you know, the older definitions of burnout were that you were too stressed, and because you were too stressed, you simply couldn't handle or deal with the situation, and so you became burnt out. A more modern definition, and one that I think is more applicable, is that when you are burnt out, what's happening is that the amount of work that you're being given does not match with the resources that you have. It's not about the fact that you should be handling it. There are many situations in which it may not be appropriate for you to be handling that much. Nevertheless, if you have that much going on, it can burn you out. And if it burns you out, what it actually does is it starts to make you feel like you can't cope with what's happening and that life is impossible, because burnout occurs in stages. And, you know, the earlier stages of burnout are situations where you are, you know, you're trying to smile, but you don't really feel like smiling. You're smiling inauthentically. You find yourself getting a bit annoyed, and that just goes on until you become quite irritated and reactive, until the later stages of burnout, where you start feeling deflated, and then eventually so fatigued that you can't get out of bed. And so with burnout, what we want to do is try to prevent it. And so one of the reasons I brought it up in the course was that I thought it was really important to let people know that sometimes we don't even realize that we're burned out. All we think is that life is tough and things are feeling kind of impossible and things are not working out. Well, what I wanted to teach in this course was, if life starts to feel that way, then go back and look at your life and say, is it possible that I'm burned out? And what you can do is then try to ask yourself a number of different questions around that. And once you get a sense of whether you're burned out or not, there are certain things that you can do. Because there are multiple causes of burnout. I mean, for every individual, there are different things. But when it gets down to it, there are just certain factors that can cause burnout. Not feeling connected with the community, work overload, excessive amounts of cynicism. These kinds of factors can actually cause burnout. And people need to be aware that when they are feeling these feelings, it's not always conscious. So what I would recommend is, the moment you start to think that something in life is impossible, ask yourself, could I be burnt out? And in what direction am I moving? Am I moving from the early stages to the late stages, or am I safe enough?
So burnout doesn't have to stop you from going in that same direction. You just need to reframe it, right?
That's right. Well, I think what you have to do is reappraise what you're doing and reframe what you're doing. I think when people are burnt out, part of that impossibility thinking is they feel that they just simply have to continue to do what they've always been doing, and that there's no way out, and there's no way that they can actually help themselves. But I think that, and we've seen this through the research, that if people actually try to change what they're doing, if they actually try to reframe what they're doing, or if they find that they can refocus on something or train their attention to focus on relevant things, this can actually decrease the amount of burnout. This connects to another concept that I talked about, which had to do with optimism and pessimism, because people say so often, oh, you know, that's just reality. I mean, you know, life sucks. What can I do? I just, you know, there's no way. I mean, look how much war there is. look how selfish people are. I mean, you can come up with a billion reasons for why life is difficult. What I would recommend is it possible to take a look at that and realize that both the optimist and the pessimist are correct? The only difference is about what they are choosing to focus on. Because while it is true that there are a lot of horrible things in life, it is also true that there are a ton of beautiful things in life. You really don't have to look that far. Just look outside your window. Look at nature. Just look at the sky. Look at the beautiful food that surrounds you. You know, even if you're in a place where you feel like you don't have enough resources, think about people who love you. Think about things that are just fundamentally beautiful. There are a lot of beautiful things in the world. And what we say is, oh, well, you know, what's the point paying attention to that when life is terrible? My point about that is that we have to train our brains over time to learn to take in positive things because we want to nourish our brain. You know, what we feed our brain makes those things grow. So if we feed negative things to our brain, they grow in our mind. If we feed positive things to our brains actually begin to feel nourished by that. And I want to emphasize that, you know, my whole attitude towards this is not, let's be happy all the time because life is great and there's never a bad moment. Of course there are bad moments. Of course there are stressful days. Of course there are times when you feel completely down and you feel like you just wish everybody that you knew was just not there and you could replace your life. Most people in the world have that feeling. However, most people in the world just switch out of that feeling into some kind of neutral position without practicing feeling positive. And I think that there are so many reasons to think about changing your life in a positive way, not just at an emotional level, you know, even at a physical level. We know from all sorts of studies that things like loneliness, for example, can actually change your immunity. There are cells called CD4 cells, which are fighter cells, T lymphocytes, that are sometimes decreased when people are extremely lonely. And this can actually affect your physical health. We know from studies on heart disease that depression is a really important contributor to heart disease. And, you know, we know that people who have anxiety, who have panic attacks, often have cardiac problems. So there's a strong connection between your emotional being and your physical being. And if you can find a way to train yourself now to take in good things, to nourish your body and nourish yourself, you will find that you're in a much better position.
So is daydreaming good or bad for you? I mean, I could see where daydreaming would actually help you to visualize or to start dreaming about a different future.
Yeah, I think when daydreaming is a break, I think it's really helpful. I think if daydreaming is a habit, it's not helpful. And I think if you're dreaming and you're hoping and wishing, but you're not acting into your inspiration, that's also a problem. So I agree. I think that daydreaming, when it's a break as part of your daily life, is really important because what it allows your brain to do is to unplug and recharge. It basically says, okay, I'm not going to overfocus. I'm going to give my brain a chance to recover from hyper-focusing, and I'm going to give it more energy. It's a little bit like filling gas. You can think of your brain that way, that you actually need to make sure that it is fueled properly. And if you just keep on running it, you'll be running out of gas. You'll be running on empty. And so what's important about daydreaming is that it allows you to refill your brain with a lot more energy so that you can tackle the next task.
Okay, so let's talk about the energy of your thoughts. And this is somewhat a controversial subject, but I would love to get your opinion on it. Can your thoughts actually materialize without you putting any action in it? Because I do remember times in my life where I simply thought about it and really wanted it, and it came to be. So is it possible, or is it just coincidence?
Yeah, no, absolutely. My feeling about that is that for some people, and probably for people like yourself, you're not just thinking about it. You're probably representing it in your brain in a very powerful way. You probably have your emotions. You probably have your unconscious in sync with your conscious brain. And so it's creating the circumstances where you are put in a position where this comes to you. You know, so let's take an example of wanting money or wanting, let's just take wanting money because it's a sort of an easier way to go about thinking about this. people will often say, well, I was just thinking about, man, I wish I could get some money. And the next thing I know, I actually went to my mailbox and I found an envelope with some money in it. And just by thinking those positive thoughts, it attracted the money to me. And what I would say is, I don't know of any biological mechanism that brings the envelope into your mailbox. But what I do know is that what we can say is that we don't know what that mechanism is, but we do know that if you want money and you represent that in your brain will be on the lookout for opportunities. So you may, for example, think of an investment and you say, wow, I just thought about money and I just, you know, put some money in an investment and it really paid off. Well, you didn't just think about the money. Your brain was actually doing that unconscious work. Having said that, I think what I'd want to say is that I've had a similar experience on many occasions about what you're speaking about. And my sense is that the more truthful thing for me to say about that is that I don't understand how it happens, which is why I wasn't talking about it in this course. But I do think that there are situations in which you can represent a thought strongly in your mind and it feels as though what you want is coming to you.
Can that be attributed to spirituality? Many people say our thoughts are prayers. Is that correct?
Absolutely. You know, I think the studies on prayer are really confusing. The last major studies that were done on prayer showed that prayer didn't have any generalized effect. But my feeling about that was that it's very hard to generalize because not everybody prays with the same intensity. Not everybody prays in the same way. It's you know, it's like being on 500 different drugs because at different doses. If you did a study where you took 20 people and you gave them all different doses of different drugs and you tried to see whether the drug worked, it's a very sort of you probably will find that the drug doesn't work. So it's the same thing with prayer. I think that with prayer, we need to really try to standardize it better if we want to study it, so that people do the same prayer at the same time. But a lot of people have said that prayer is incredibly powerful, and I do believe that prayer creates a kind of inner synchrony and brain rest, so that whatever usually obstructs your path to getting you to where you need to get to is diminished, and you are able to see solutions better than before you were praying.
Brilliant. I love this. Dr. Pillay, let me ask you something about you. You are the assistant clinical professor of Harvard Medical School, a psychiatrist, and a person that is intent in helping the world to realize the power of our mind and thoughts. What motivated you to focus on the brain and the law of attraction? I mean, this isn't something that the Western medicine is actually focusing on. So how did you get involved?
Well, I think part of what happened was when I was at medical school, somebody actually, we had a talk on transcendental meditation. And people were explaining how when you meditate, it can actually affect the field around your mind. And this can actually is associated with Einstein's theories. And I thought, what a load of nonsense. And so, you know, I thought, what is this person talking about? And someone said to me, well, if you're a real scientist, why don't you try it out? Why don't you actually try meditating for like 3 to 6 months, see if it makes a difference to your life and if it changes your life in general? And so I said, okay. And they said, you know, don't try to prove this wrong. Just be a real scientist. Try it out and see if it makes a difference in your life. So I did try it out. And it was one of the most powerful experiences of my entire life. What I found was that by meditating, there were all these seeming unseen forces that seemed to be at play. And all of a sudden, I found, you know, my exam results improving, my relationships improving. There were just so many profound effects that I began to feel incredibly interested in understanding what these phenomena were. But if I'm truthful about it, I think that I've always been engaged by the mysterious components of life, the parts of life where you can't quite explain things. You know, things like beauty, for instance. Yes, you can. I'm sure there are ways you can quantitate degrees of brightness or degrees of redness. But there is a very compelling aspect of life which is hugely subjective. And even though I am very invested in helping people by providing scientific evidence for what they're feeling, I am a strong believer in the subjective, and I do believe that what propels me is not knowing these answers and trying to find these answers. And so my whole journey along the path of spirituality and faith has been to continue to question until I find some kind of satisfying answer. And I find that what the biology does is it doesn't necessarily provide an answer. It gives me some sense of reason to hold on to as I'm beginning to explore what is going on in the spiritual space. And by the spiritual space, really, what I'm talking about is a place where I feel not in my usual state of alertness and consciousness, where my mind feels lighter. I don't feel as connected to gravity as I do in my waking state. And in that mind state, I can feel the capacity for some kind of creativity. You know, I believe that there are creative forces in consciousness that are beyond our immediate understanding. And what I feel is that the meditation is increasingly revealing to me what some of these creative capacities are. And, you know, people may say, well, you know, that sounds like a whole lot of nonsense. You know, what does that mean that thought can have creative capacity? And I would say, well, I don't know. Do you understand how creative capacity exists at all? Because I don't. And they say, of course, the way we're created is that you have a sperm and an ovum, and it forms a zygote, and that then forms a baby eventually, and then the baby grows up, and that's how things are created. And then I will say, what on earth makes those two things come together? Right. And what on earth makes them join and form cells, and what makes the cells divide? I mean, what is the energy behind that? Now, you could say, well, it's not an energy, it's a process. And I'd say, okay, call it what you want. Call it a process, call it an energy. What is directing this activity? You know, for me, I think the answer is I don't know. But I am really engaged by that in life, and I'm engaged by the fact that there seems to be some likeness between certain moments in the transcendental state and trying to understand this process that occurs in creation. I don't believe that we need rational thought for understanding only. I think there are many forms of understanding that are non-rational. I like to distinguish between irrational and non-rational. I think there's rational, which is pure logic. There's non-rational, which is often things like emotions and spirituality. And then there's irrational, which is stuff that doesn't make sense. And I think there's a lot of stuff that makes sense that's within the non-rational realm. And so my feeling has been throughout that even as I'm writing all of these books about the biology, about brain biology, that I don't see things as separate. I don't see the brain as being separate from spirituality. I don't think that spirituality is necessarily created by the brain, but I do think that the brain can transmit energies and acts, as I said, like a radio. So if you ask me, well, where's the source of the energy? I wish I knew. What I do know is that the more I meditate, the more I feel the subjective sensation that there's some kind of understanding. And that understanding transcends logical understanding to me. It is a kind of it creates a kind of satisfaction that I think is really compelling. And when I talk to my atheist friends about this, and I talk to people who don't believe in spirituality, you know, they say things like, well, oh, that sounds like a great delusion. You know, it's a nice feeling of comfort and understanding that occurs in a transcendent space. It just sounds like a delusion. It sounds like an altered state of consciousness. You might as well get drunk or take drugs and say how great everything feels. And I will say, I'll grant you that. You know, I'll grant you that it could be a delusion. But what I'm going to tell you is that you don't know because you're not exploring that. So if you explore that and then conclude that it's a delusion, it will be a very different set of data. And my path is a path of asking and questioning so that I can understand.
Wow, that is powerful. You're getting into the philosophy of life, aren't you?
I am, yeah. You know, I think what we're talking about here at some level is how do we interact with the universe? Mm. And, you know, one of the texts that I enjoy particularly, and I should just say off the bat that my feeling about religion is that I really think that if we are going to absorb ourselves in the texts of religion, and in the feeling around religion, that we actually use that to get closer to each other, that I find the moment religion starts to separate you from the world and people, it's probably acting against its own purpose. But having said that, one of the influential texts in my life has been the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, which is a description in English and Sanskrit of some fundamental processes in consciousness. And I think one of the segments that really appealed to me and some of my awareness in neuroscience had to do with what true understanding is. Because there was a segment that talked about, there's a word, a Sanskrit word, and I actually don't speak Sanskrit or any Indian languages, but there's a Sanskrit word called dharana, which is essentially focusing your concentration on an object. So you say, well, how do you understand the object? You say, oh, I look at it. And so that's a static condition. Then there's another condition called dhyana, which is a state of looking at the object, but you continue to look at it. Your awareness flows toward the object continuously. And then there's a thing called a samadhi, which is where you look at the object for so long, and your consciousness and awareness and attention is looking at it for so long that it loses its form. And then there's another state that is called samyama, which is essentially where focusing, flow of concentration, and the dissolution of form all come together. And in that, you really feel like you have an understanding of the thing you're looking at. So I don't feel that, you know, the conventional meaning of understanding for most people is many words for one. You know, it's sort of like, what is the table? A table is a piece of furniture that has a flat surface and four legs. It's like, okay, so you're just using many words for one. Are you really telling me what that is? You know, if I say, who is Jules? You say, well, Jules is a woman who X, Y, Z. Well, sure, you can describe those characteristics, but does it really feel like you are close to that? Because what I feel is understanding needs to transcend simply looking and commenting. It needs to transcend simply pointing at the moon, and instead needs to feel like being on the moon. Mm-hmm. And when you are on the moon, you have a very different understanding than if you are pointing at it. And so, and you know, that's not an original thought. It's a thought from fundamental Buddhism. But I think it's a very helpful thought, because what it does is it actually creates a context in which you can understand how to interact with the universe. And I want to make the point also, because it just comes to my mind, that you know my own context and background sort of stems from a different norm of Hinduism and a lot of Buddhist principles. But I want to say that part of the reason the norm was different was that part of the way I was raised was to understand that the kind of Hindu that I was taught to be was someone who understood that all religions are equally important. And sometimes I have friends who feel shy about the fact that they feel intensely Christian, or that they feel like they are devout because they're afraid that people are going to identify them with fanatical people. And what I'd want to say about that is that I think that our modern parlance has gotten us into talking about these phenomena the way I'm talking about it, sort of cognitively and spiritually and in terms of energy. But there are people in the world who are just absorbed in the notion of Jesus Christ. There are people who are absorbed in the notion of going to church. There are people who are absorbed in whatever their religions are. I think that as long as your understanding is helped by these connections, there's no reason to be shy about that. You know, I think it's important to be able to understand it. And again, for me, what I use as the beacon of understanding is the ability to feel connected to others through my own personal view, rather than being separated from others. Because the moment I find myself separated from others, I start to say, wait a minute, is this just my ego playing into this? Because, you know, one of the problems with religion, aside from fundamentalism, which I think can be really obstructive, is that I think that religion generally is interpreted by all of us. You know, we are the carriers of that information. All of that amazing information that resides in spiritual scriptures and texts has to be processed by our brain. So what do you think is happening in your brain when you're reading a religious scripture and your mind is preoccupied by all the horrible things in the day and what your boss did to you and how the person next door to you was trying to backstab you, it's all that information is getting processed through your brain. You're probably not reading the scripture in the way it was originally written. You're reading it through the lens of your own mind. And so I think it's important to be mindful of that all the time, because sometimes we get carried away with our own interpretations of things. And I like to check in with myself, and I like to check in with others to make sure that what I'm doing is serving what I think are the important priorities, which is a certain amount of self-development, a certain amount of other development, and a certain amount of development that involves myself and others at the same time. And as long as I think we can check in with ourselves, we can keep ourselves from a certain kind of fanaticism and actually try to be more engaged with ourselves and live as a more successful community of people.
Aren't you really talking about the word judgment?
Absolutely.
So there appears to be a fine line as to good judgment versus bad judgment, and judgment that keeps you stuck and keeps you from going forward. And there's such a fine line, it's hard to even grasp.
Well, you know, I think of judgment in two ways. I think of it in a superficial way, and I think of it in a deeper way. You know, if I had to be truthful about it, what I would say is that I have moments in my day when I feel incredibly judgmental. And I often will feel judgmental about people who are annoying me or people who hurt people I'm close to. Now, in the moment, I do have a parallel state of consciousness. I do think simultaneously that I am judging these people and I'm just feeling irritated with them. But I also know that something in this process of judgment is ridiculous. So I think discernment is different from judgment, because discernment allows you to distinguish between different states of consciousness and different kinds of preferences, and it allows you to choose a path for development. I think what judgment does is it stops you in your tracks. It essentially commits you to the jail cell of your own anger. And the moment you are trapped in that cage, you can't escape it. So even if you don't think about it in terms of other people, when judgment is simply a cage in which you keep yourself because you can't stand what's outside of yourself, that actually stops you in your tracks. And so I think a really important reason to free yourself from judgment is to not be caged yourself. I think what people don't realize is that they form a community of jail cellmates. It's like, hi, I'm jailed, you're jailed, we're all jailed. Now we have a great community. And the question I would ask is, are you really experiencing the freedom that you deserve? Do you think that the judgment is enhancing your movement through life? Or do you feel like the judgment is actually stopping that? And my general feeling is that the judgment does stop that. But, you run into problems where people start judging themselves about being judgmental.
That's exactly right, and that's where I get stuck.
And then I say, look at that again. You know, I think it's important to cultivate the habit of watching our thoughts. It's important to cultivate the habit of watching our judgments, because the more you start to watch your thoughts and emotions, and the more you start to watch your judgments, the more you recognize that your thoughts and emotions, all of these things, are just projections of yourself, that the experience of yourself is something very different than all these thoughts and emotions. And we get stuck in thoughts and emotions because we believe that we are our thoughts and emotions. My own belief is that we are not our thoughts and emotions. That thoughts and emotions are expressions of the brain, and they guide us toward an experience of the self. An experience of the self becomes more evident when we still our minds. And when we still our minds, we get to experience all these negative and positive poles. You know, one of the things I talk about sometimes is this idea of a cellular approach to development and adventure and entrepreneurship. Because when we have negatives and positives in our minds at the same time, it takes a certain amount of strength to let them both be there and to be between them and let them flow without judging them. So I feel that judgment fundamentally is obstructive. I think it's human to have it, but I think it's important to be on the lookout for it, because eventually judgment becomes a cage that keeps you isolated. Mm. And of course you're going to have opinions about other people. Of course you're going to have sort of certain kinds of preferences or prejudices. You know, I have a whole chapter on prejudice in Life Unlocked, where we talk about the fact that we are often automatically predisposed to having judgments and prejudices. I think that these things happen, but I think what we can do with this is realize that we can change the way we feel. And I don't think people need to be compelled simply by some sense of morality or do-goodness or force themselves into a position. I think deeply, how is the judgment truly serving me? And if I were not to be judgmental, what would I free myself to feel? Because judgment, at a fundamental level, is really a state of worry. And we now know that worry is not anxiety. It is a way of not addressing existential anxiety and a way of making it controllable, because we can't stand the fact that if we are really with ourselves, there is something that we are not in control of. So we create controllable things like worry and judgment, and we attach ourselves to that. And in the process, we lose contact with these flowing forces that flow through our being.
Oh my gosh, that is so good. Wow. Excellent. Let's tell everybody where they can go to find out more information about you and to buy your books.
Sure. My website is www.srinipillay.com. And my books are available on Amazon. So, in fact, the other book was just soft launched yesterday, my third book, Your Brain and Business, The Neuroscience of Great Leaders, where I talk about the interaction between emotions and the brain and making money, and how this actually applies to living in an environment. You know, just to give you a sense related to what we're talking about, there's an institute called the Institute of Conscious Capitalism, the Conscious Capitalism Institute, actually, at Bentley Business School, just outside of Boston, where a lot of influential people looked at a business study where they tried to see what kinds of companies spend small amounts of money on marketing but have large profit margins. And one of the similarities that emerged is that all of those companies were actually conscious of the community, and they were conscious of community needs. And somehow being conscious of community needs meant that they attracted their customers rather than actually so having to spend large amounts of money on marketing.
Wow. Yes, I fully understand that concept. You know, I have paid out very, very little marketing dollars to promote Law of Attraction Radio Network. But yet, we're in 120 countries. We have literally hundreds of thousands of millions of listeners because we attracted it.
Right, absolutely.
It's so wonderful to have a scientist confirm that. Now, you do personal coaching, do you not?
That's right. I do personal and executive coaching, and I am a certified master coach as well, and I am the CEO of Neuro Business Group, which is stationed in Cambridge, Massachusetts, but we have branches in Switzerland, in Greece. We've worked in Brazil, and we're developing our branches there and in South Africa as well. You know, we have people all over the country and in Canada as well. So we're growing throughout the world, and we're working with people in a number of different business environments at a personal level too, because I think that the coaching can really be helpful.
And you're teaching conscious business techniques, right?
Absolutely, because that's where I think the greatest power is. You know, if you actually talk about, you know, one of the things I did once was I had an interview with Peter Buffett, who's Warren Buffett's son. And he talked about what it was like to grow up with the richest man in the world. And what he said was, sometimes he'd be hanging out in his house and his dad would be sitting at the table poring over all of the figures. But the way in which he was examining them, he said it felt like being in a house with intense spirituality, because there was something about his consciousness and the level of his concentration and the way he was absorbed in that seemed completely transcendent. So that's a sort of, you know, a case history of a real life example where someone is saying that their business decisions seem to come from a state of consciousness that was not simply literally just looking at something. It seemed like it was a more evolved state of consciousness.
Wow. And there you have the secret of success for the world's richest person, Mr. Warren Buffett. I am so sorry to say that we're out of time, but Dr. Pillay, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, for doing this magnificent course at the University of Attraction, and especially for being such an incredible blessing to this world and to everybody in it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate being there. I truly appreciate working with you and feeling your energy, Jules, and I know that this is going to be incredibly successful, because really what you're putting out to the world is a message that they can get what they've dreamt of. And the fact that there are all of these facts to back that up, I think makes it an even stronger message. So thank you for spreading the word in this. I think it's really inspirational.
Thank you, Dr. Pillay. And to all my wonderful, incredible, magnificent listeners out there, have a great week. And just remember to monitor your thoughts. Love you. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with another great show. For more information, go to lawofattractiontools.com or contact Jules personally at Jules@LOARadionetwork.com.